Hello, you are tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Deborah McFadder from Flagstaff, with excerpts from Yes Magazine, a nonprofit independent publisher of solutions journalism. We start our session with something from the climate section of this media, Rooted in the Diaspora. This was written by Sanjana Sekar, first published April 3rd, 2024. There's an illustration that is a drawing, a large bowl of soup or stew that has carrots and something yellow and some green sprigs like parsley in it, a napkin with a fork and knife, and some a round-shaped container that is a contact lens holder. Behind it, there are four rectangles that have drawings of an older woman, a younger woman with her daughter, an even younger woman and her daughter. There are two more rectangles that show a woman and a young girl, and a fourth young woman and a very young girl. And the scenery behind them is different. The older woman is in front of the Taj Mahal or some building like that. One of the pictures has as a background canyon area of the United States. One has a rural road, and one has a suburban street with houses on it. Evolving technology and place-based knowledge help a family connect with joy while far from home and one another. Thursday, February 9th, 2023. I'm bundled in a wool overcoat against the 6 a.m. winter chill of Los Angeles. The former New Yorker in me scoffs at how soft I've become against the cold, or rather, the, in quotes, cold, since it's a full 50 degrees and I'm shivering. Today's high is 80, so by noon I'll have stripped down to a crop top. I know it's climate change and all, but I'd be lying if I said I'm not just a tiny bit excited for a short reprieve from the monotonous months of 50 degrees and rainy that we've been having this winter. The morning frost on my Subaru is tenacious, even after I run the engine for a little while. I'm bordering on late for Katak class, so I pull out of the driveway with icy windows and hurry to beat the rush hour traffic. In the studio, it's a steady thrum of the tabla over the stereo system. Ta kitata tikata kinka. Ta kitata kikata kina. Ta kitata kitata. Gina, dia, gina, dia. And then a relentlessly driving pace of chakar, or one count spins. Tick, da, tick, 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 ek, do, teen, char, pach, jar, das. And on and on. After an hour of this, I'm breathless. We've been drilling a composition with 31 chakar, and even after months, I'm losing my balance somewhere around 26. I leave class and head back to my car, protein shake in hand, sweat gluing my kurta to my skin, a string of profanities running through my mind as I scold myself for tapping out at 26. I've just slipped into my driver's seat when my phone rings. One peek at the screen and my mood elevates. Hi, Amma, I say with unrestrained fondness as my mother's face grins back at me over FaceTime. Hi, Gina. She responds with equal affection. Just finished katak? Yeah, about to head to the grocery store on my way home. Shall we quickly call Amma Mama before she sleeps? Sure, my parking meter's out in 10, though. We can just say hi. FaceTime or WhatsApp? FaceTime. Can you add her in? 1 minute. After some shuffling around, a second little box populates on my screen, offering me the stray wisps of white hair, otherwise known as the top of my grandmother's head. Hi, Amma Mama, I say. Hi, Amma, my mom chirps. Hi, Kana, Buje Kana Re, Sweetie Kana, croons my Amma Mama's forehead. How are you both? Good. Can you bring the phone down? I say, holding back a laugh. We only see the top of your head. Amma and I call Amma Mama together every week. It used to be Sundays, like clockwork, when I was in grade school. Now it's sort of whenever we catch each other. Every week we remind her to tilt the phone down so we can actually see her face. And every week she insists on greeting us with her forehead. A mama's puttering around her kitchen in Hyderabad, 8,711 miles away from me in California. My memory conjures up the smell of hearty palakura papu and fluffy idli, chili-spiced tur dal roasting on the tava for homemade poti, the softness of her orange sari, palu tied securely around her waist so it stays out of the way of her busy hands. She's lived alone in Tarnaka for almost 40 years, ever since my grandfather passed away. She's 85 now and wobbles about her small flat with the vigor and determined independence of a 20-year-old. My ama got this from her, I think. I swear my ama will be single-handedly shoveling piles of snow as tall as she is, 5 whole feet, from her Park City, Utah driveway until she's 90 years old. I tell Amama about Kathak class, and she glows with pride. Very good, Kana. Very good. I'm very glad you're keeping up with Kathak. Very good. I'll show you this new composition when I next come, Amama. She smiles the most when I promise this. Every year, when we visit her in India, I dance for her. In those 15 minutes while she watches, she's filled with more childlike joy, more wonder, more freedom of spirit than any other moment I see her. My grandma, like many women in her generation, carries a deep anxiety. Kathak transcends that, transports us together, unlocks her. Dance is hardly my profession, but it has a cemented place in my life as a psychosomatic way to stay rooted in culture and family from half a world away, as a way of staying connected to Amama. I am a Chestunabo. Ama, what are you doing? My mom asks her mother. I am Latu, just putting away the food. What did you make for dinner? Nothing much, Amama says. Some papanam, that is all. Tomorrow I'll make some cabbage gura. She pauses in her puttering to pick up something from the counter. See? Do you see the cabbage? Amama adjusts the angle of the camera in an effort to show us her cabbage. Do you see? But she's pointing the camera at her ceiling, and I'm having a hard time repressing any laughter. No, Amama, we can't see. You're showing us the ceiling. Amama adjusts the angle again, and now we're feasting our eyes on a sliver of her ceiling that's been joined by a section of her wall. Now do you see? Do you see the cabbage? Ama is openly laughing. No, Ma, we don't see the cabbage. You're showing the wall. Another unsuccessful adjustment then. Okay, now do you see the cabbage? Do you see the cabbage? Amama's excitement is only intensifying, but no appearance from any cabbage thus far. Now Ama and I are both shaking with mirth. Do you see it? Amama continues to insist. We don't answer because we're too busy gasping for breath. Then, miraculously, we see a sliver of a blurry green leaf flash across her FaceTime screen. Oh, Ama and I both shout. We see it, Amama. Yes, yes, we see it, Ma. You see the cabbage? You see it? Yes, yes, Amama, we see the cabbage. Now even Amama is laughing. I screenshot this moment several times, never wanting to forget these small winks of diasporic joy. The three of us spread across 3 cities and 3 generations, giggling like sisters together on a sunshine summer afternoon. It's not long before Amama's chuckles turn into coughs, peppered by a sort of rough wheezing that I learned as a child is part of her chronic asthma. My parking meter blinks red. Tuesday, November 19th, 2047. I'm in the front yard doling out carefully measured sprinkles of water to the small garden I've struggled to nurture for the last several growing seasons. The water rations for Victory Gardens have gotten more and more economical over the last 10 years. In our little patch, we still get tomatoes and kale and grow some neem, and the occasional surprise potatoes spring out from wherever we've last dug in compost. The rest of our food comes from the community garden, which does better some years than others. The local co-op, which is not always well stocked because it hasn't quite yet reached financial stability, or with great burden to our wallets, anything requiring long-distance freight costs an arm and a leg now, partially because it's just too expensive at a basic resource and carbon level, and partially because of the taxes they've been trying to institute on non-local food. It's been a rough transition period. Here in California, we have the farming infrastructure, but not the water. In other parts of the country, land that's been monocropped under generations of agribusiness is in various stages of transition to regenerative farming. The question of who pays for this transition, what carbon taxes get charged or credited, and to whom, and who leads the proposed solutions that take the place of the old order, well, it's been a thorny time. But it's also a time of inspired experimentation. I remind myself of that when the overwhelm hits. I remind myself of the energy. Where we live in the historically black neighborhood of Limert Park, our family's borne witness and supported as those who've been holding it down here for generations lead the charge on collective care. Community gardens, co-ops, free fridges, heat shelters, communal front yard victory gardens, shade tree planting, seed saving, after-school programs, buy-nothing gift economy groups, car shares, and so much more. Funding is a constant issue for these initiatives right now. The biggest source of funding is private donors, but the community is keenly problem-solving for a self-sufficient model. Everything's decided at our monthly town hall meetings, which are always lively and full of opinions. There's a small group of us South Asians in the neighborhood, and our agreed-upon job at these meetings is mostly to listen well and provide the chai. Out in the garden, dusk is dancing vividly before me, blues chasing pinks, chasing oranges across the hazy horizon. I always stop to cherish it, never knowing how many more I'll savor before the smog swallows up color altogether. I pause over the far end of the garden, which has been exceptionally dry no matter how much I try to feed it. It's honestly a little embarrassing. My neighbor's victory gardens look far more luscious than mine. The community decided at one of our first meetings years ago that victory gardens would go in the front yard, communal, conversational, open, and engaging, rather than in the backyard, hidden, private, inaccessible. 99% of the time, I love that we made this decision. The 1% is just the occasional despair I feel when I remember that my garden is on display and not in the best shape, and my ego gets to me. I make a mental note to hop next door tomorrow to Amrit and Hari's to ask Hari what cover crops are working in his yard these days. His green thumb has always guided mine, and maybe he'll show how to better nourish this dry patch. You are tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from Yes. From somewhere inside the house, my phone rings. Ama, Gita's voice calls to me. It's Ama, Ma. Her 5-foot frame, identical to mine, comes bounding through the open screen door, my phone in her hand. Gita's hair is curly like mine, and I effin' love that about her. She's smart as a whip, and I love it even more about her. Sometimes I look at her and I marvel at the fact that I made that creature. Now I understand what my Ama's always saying about having a kid is like putting your heart outside of yourself and watching it walk around, or some stuff like that. Sometimes I want to gather Gita up and store her safely back inside my body. She comes over to me and scoops me into an affectionate hug before setting the phone up flat on the porch table and hitting answer. We both activate the bracelets on our wrists. Almost immediately, a spark of light projects upwards from the beam projection port on my phone, and a 3-dimensional hologram of my mother takes shape from the light. Hi, Ama, I say. Hi, Ama-ma, Gita says brightly. Hello, hello, my mother says. I can't see you. No matter how many times we do this, she always comes in perplexed at the beginning of a beam call. Amma, did you put it face down on the table again? Allery Bila, troublemaker, I kept it properly face up. I'm not that technologically challenged, but still I don't see you. Did you turn the brightness back up, or is it in night mode? Oh, 1 minute. How do I do that again? There's a control on your bracelet. This is why I was saying you should just leave it on the automatic setting. I can figure it out. I don't like how bright it is on the auto. It makes my eyes burn. We watch her hologram self fidget with something off camera before lighting up into light. Got it, she says. Hi, oh, Gita, you're looking so nice. Are you going somewhere? Thanks, Amama, Gita says. I was invited to a prayer circle tonight in preparation for the burns next week. Elena is leading, and she told me I could bring some jasmine and haldi and chandan as offerings from our family. For the past several years, Gita's been volunteering with the Tongva Conservancy's ceremonial burns, covering any responsibility she's invited to participate in. Fire season has worsened over the last 10 years in California, so many regions, including LA County, realized survival depended on working with local tribes to revive cultural burning practices. The prescribed burns that indigenous folks across the world have practiced culturally since time immemorial kept rampant dry brush under control and created a cycle of nourishment for the forests until colonialism outlawed the practice. In LA, the late fall burning they've restarted allows for plant life to rejuvenate in the rainy winter season, the goal being to once again transform dry underbrush into verdant vegetation come spring. How are you going there? My ama asks Gita. I thought your driving permits are Monday, Wednesday, Saturday. Elena got a Tuesday slot in the community car share, so she's coming to pick me up. I think she got one of those Rivian two doors. Fancy, I say. Gita goes inside to start gathering her things while I ask Amma what she's up to. Not much, Amma replies. Just making your Amama's cabbage gura. Tease, I accuse. I sent you seeds last year, Amma says defensively. Yeah, but they don't grow, I told you. The water they need is way beyond our rations. We bicker warmly about cabbage kura, a nostalgic but water-intensive vegetable I probably haven't eaten in 15 years at this point. As the cool night air sets in, Amma's hologram shines brightly above the porch table. A few stray moths, confused, start circling in the vicinity. I watch their wings disturb the pixels here and there. When Elena's car, indeed a Rivian two-door, pulls up, Gita flashes by me with a kiss and hops in, leaving the divine aroma of jasmine and chatan in her wake. At the same time, a second set of footsteps tip-tap up the stairs from the street into our garden, and I'm engulfed in a familiar embrace. Hi, buddy, a voice coos at me. It's Aditi, close friend and co-conspirator. She plops her bike, helmet, and backpack onto a chair on our porch. Seeing that my mom's on beam on the table, she grins. Hi, Auntie! She hits the join button on her beam bracelet so that my mom can see her hologram, then sprawls out in the grass beside me. How are you? Hi, Aditi. Good. How are you? How's Noor? They're good. They're still at the courthouse, or they would have come by with me. Then Aditi nods at her backpack and looks at me conspiratorially. I went to the Indian store today. I let out a hoop. This is a luxury we reserve only for special occasions. Shut up! What are we celebrating? Well, Noor beamed me from the courthouse today and told me that our permit request for the collective is next in line for consideration and that they think we're a sure thing. Amma's hologram gasps. The housing collective? The one and only, Aditi says. That night, with Amma still on beam, Aditi pulls out fresh guavas and late-season mangoes, a rare pleasure all the way from the subcontinent, and we twirl around. Takita-takita-gina. Takita-takita-gina. Between bites of home. Friday, July 9th, 2077. I eye the box on my coffee table with suspicion. Gita's had some strange contraption called Iris delivered to me, and she swears it's worth whatever trouble it surely brings. I asked Aditi and Noor about it, and they agreed that the concept of sticking digital contact lenses in one's eyes is unpleasant, to say the least. Gita instructed me to be open to it and threatened to call me an old codger if I refused to even try it out. Iris makes your eye a projector, Amma. Your eye! Can you believe it? It'll be like Reina and I are there with you, 3D, walking and talking and interacting with you and your space. Like we're literally there, she'd said when we last talked. The idea of feeling like my daughter and granddaughter are physically with me ultimately makes Iris an easy sell, despite my hesitations. Remembering her words, I decide to open the damn box. After great difficulty and no small amounts of grumbling, I finally affix the small, translucent contacts to my eyes, and scrutinizing the user manual, I figure out how to power on this incredibly invasive piece of technology. I've had it on for less than 2 minutes when the accompanying earbud headphones inform me that I have an incoming call. It is, of course, Gita. Amma, she shouts joyfully, you did it! You finally listened to me! This is so cool! I'm not sure exactly what is so cool, as my vision is blurry and I'm completely baffled by how she could possibly be seeing me right now, but I take her word for it. Gita does some troubleshooting that I don't understand, laughs at me quite a few times for being a bumbling fool with this new device, and finally coaches me through getting the focus and the lens calibrated. And then I see what's so cool. Gita has set it so that the simulated world we're in is my real front yard. I'm really here, right now, lying in the grass. And it looks like they are too, as full-scale renderings of their real selves. They can interact with me, with my garden. On their end, Gita tells me it's like being in virtual reality. She tells me that next time we'll make the setting her house, where she and Reina can move around in the real world and I'll be visiting via virtual reality. Once I've quit my grumblings, we settle into our regular pattern of conversation. What we're all eating, how everyone's love interests are, whether we're taking care of our health. Except it is quite cool because the whole time it's like Gita and Reina are lounging in the yard with me. I tell them this reminds me of way back when I was a kid in India, loitering outside all afternoon with my cousins. You used to go to India every year, Amama? Reina asks me, eyes wide. Every year. We were very lucky. Do you think you'll ever go back? With the flight restrictions, it's almost impossible, I say. Now I think I'd take me 3 trains and a whole ass ship. No, I don't think I'll ever be able to go back. But sometime in the future, I think you will. My girls both reach out to me as glittering pixels in the golden summer afternoon. I like how realistically Iris portrays them, truly as if they're here in the grass with me, just like Gita promised, reaching towards me to comfort me. But the technology misses what I love most about them, their smell, the warmth of their skin, the calm in my own heart when I'm in their physical presence. When Gita told me she and her partner Gloria had decided to move away from L.A. to raise Reina somewhere that was more climate stable, I understood. My mother left her mother in India to come to America in search of a better life, an economically stable life, a life that would offer the opportunity of abundance for us, for me, after the literal and metaphorical scarcity that British colonialism imposed on the subcontinent. At the same time, who would have thought that decades later, rampant consumption and capitalism would finally deliver that same scarcity here to our doorsteps in America? Then I moved away from my mother, starting a life in L.A., in community with other South Asian storytellers who were committed to drawing attention to climate and culture. Those of us who joined the movement as soon as we became conscious of it saw the writing on the wall long back, but it took the bubble actually popping around the wealthy for those in power to take any real action on what was going on. In L.A., most of the mansions in the hills got wiped out by fires long ago. A staccato of winter storms caused irreparable mudslides along Mulholland Drive. The Pacific Ocean claimed Santa Monica. The city was forced to implement retreat strategies, which led to them regulating lot sizes as more people had to relocate to the livable areas of L.A. Predictably, some millionaires really fought against this and did everything they could to rebuild their mansions and add climate protective measures. But no one ever got too far in the process because insurance companies no longer cover houses built in long designated hazard zones. And after a certain point, with all the carbon taxes levied on any building project that exceeds reciprocal resourcing standards, the mansions were no longer financially viable. Other millionaires were shockingly supportive of the lot size restrictions and wound up working within reciprocal resourcing standards to build sustainable collectives. Of course, some people still went the route of save myself at the expense of others. They built bunkers with the goal of self-sufficiency. It's a seductive idea until you realize what it means is isolation from any sense of community. We are by definition interdependent. Our survival is predicated on our ability to work together. But I'm pretty sure Elon Musk's kids are still raising their families all alone in their secluded fortress. Their only outside interaction is probably with the drones that deliver their caviar. Ultimately, it was the local resilience, the grassroots ideas, the place-based knowledge that allowed us to survive. These days, I live at Auntie Gang Collective. The name was inspired by Gita always calling me and my cherished group of South Asian women friends Auntie Gang. Here, there's no caviar. Never understood the appeal, anyway. But there's music in the streets every day. Takita, takita, ginna. This intriguing story set over many decades into the future is not finished, but we have to stop now because our time is up. You have been tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from Yes Magazine. I'm your volunteer reader from Flagstaff, Deborah McVatter. Thanks a lot for listening.